chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Welcome to the Something Extra Podcast, where we explore the essence of leadership through authentic stories. I am Lisa Nichols, your host and CEO at Technology Partners. Today, we're thrilled to present the best moments from our 2023 episodes. Sit back, relax, and join us in reliving the essence of true leadership. Yeah, I want to continue this whole vein of talking about fear and this sort of thing, you know, and really stepping into your purpose. You've got a quote in one of your books by William James, and it says, "Many people never experience the full breadth of their own capabilities or realize their full potential because fear keeps them living inside the lines. There's a large gap between the life they did live and what could have been." And this is exactly what you just said. You didn't want to look back and go, "What if I had have done this?" And look at what you've done, Margie. My goodness. I mean, you have had so many opportunities to speak. You have coached executives. You have had an opportunity. I know you've had an opportunity to interview people like Beryl Marriott from Marriott Hotels, Richard Branson. I mean, the world has just opened up to you probably like you could have never imagined, you know, 25 years ago, if you had not stepped out there and been brave. How does fear, and you've coached a lot of executives over the years, you know, and you've got anecdotal stories about people that had fear and then they stepped out. I mean, how have you seen this play out, and how can we reframe our fears? You know, because everybody has that emotion of fear.
And let's be clear, we shouldn't vilify it. We wouldn't be here without it. So the goal should never to be fearless, even though that word fearless gets used a lot as almost a synonym for courage. In a sense, it's a misnomer, because courage isn't the absence of fear. It is the decision to take action in its presence, to risk an outcome that we don't want in pursuit of an outcome that we want far more. And so, you know, courage to me is, that's why it's weaves through all my work, through my books. My first book title, Find Your Courage, was me finding my courage, even finding the guts to write a book. There was a little voice in my head was like, "Who do you think you are? You know, you went to a little one-room schoolhouse. You don't even know where the apostrophes go. How could you aspire to write a book?" And give myself permission to write an imperfect book. And I see all the time, while fear comes in many guises, and it's often disguised as mild-mannered self-doubt, that little voice of like, "I don't know if I'm experienced enough. I don't know if I have what it takes. I could make a fool of myself. I could be rejected." You know, often that fear keeps us from taking those very actions that we are wholly capable of taking, from making a bold ask, from putting our hand up to take on a bigger role, from having a difficult conversation with an employee, with a peer, with someone we love in our family. And so to me, it's not about eradicating fear from our lives, Lisa. It's about discerning between the fears that are serving us and allowing us to grow and to learn and to thrive, and those that are stifling us. And I think the pandemic, the last few years, coupled and overlap with this 24/7 news cycle we're in, this digital news economy that really, it makes money from making us afraid. You look at the headlines. I think we've become more hypersensitive to risk, that we're constantly going, oh, that looks too scary. That looks too scary. You know, hunker down, mask up. People are very afraid. And I think many people have lost the ability to just really discern legitimate risk from perceived or, you know, risks that we need to take. And so on a kind of a macro level, you know, I think we can be afraid of the wrong things. And so part of it is reframing fear, really reframing risk and go, what is it am I putting at risk if I don't take this risk, if I don't, this emotional risk, this, you know, if I don't take this chance? And knowing also that our brains are twice as sensitive to what could go wrong than what could go right, to what could be lost than what could be gained. So a lot of people focus all the time on the downside of risk, of taking a risk, because it's immediate, it seems dramatic. It's like, oh, I'll feel terrible. And we're not as good at stepping into the shoes of us 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, or as I said with a friend of mine recently who's been, was offered a very, very big job that's going to be hugely demanding and challenging. I said, consult with your 100-year-old self, step into the shoes of her and ask yourself, what would she want you to know? What would she want you to do? Because, you know, at the end of life, it's the risks that we don't take, the chances we don't take, the times we weren't brave that we regret far more than the times that we did.
Yeah. Well, we're going to dig into it. I love the book. It is what I would consider more like a field guide, really, Dale. I mean, you've got appendices in the back, and we'll talk about that with sample correspondence. I mean, I love the way that you've organized it too. But, you know, the loss of a job is included in the top 10 most stressful stressors in life. In fact, I read one stat that said it's number 5. If you want to know what 1, 2, 3, 4 are, this is according to the Signs of Health. Number 1 is the death of a loved one, a spouse or a loved one. Number 2 would be a divorce. Number 3 would be a move, a large move of some sort. D would be a major illness or health concern. And then number 5 is a job loss. So it is in the top 10, and there is a lot, you know, of anxiety, and you talk about this, but, you know, we know that at first, maybe there's a lot more emotional and obviously financial stress and emotional stress, but we know too that stress untamed, right, Dale, can cause a lot of physical illness as well. And it can manifest itself in sleep disorders, all kinds of things. So I love that, you know, that you have written this book. You know, one of the things that you talk about in there is allowing yourself to grieve. It is a loss, loss of control, loss of professional identity, self-esteem, purposeful activity every day, daily routine. These are just some of the things and the stressors that, you know, you deal with when you lose a job. And you and I kind of talked offline, but, you know, many times, and you said it happens a lot more than people even realize, but it's not in your control. Sometimes it's in our control. Maybe there's a performance issue and you're not living up to what you agreed to do with that employer. But like in your case, it was organizational restructure where that job is just eliminated. So boy, having things like that that happen that are completely out of your control, it's difficult.
Well, and so since you mentioned those other even higher stressors, let me just talk for just a minute about the numbers to give you an idea how big job loss is in this country. So death, there's about 2.6 million deaths in this country every year. There's probably about close to 900,000 divorces in a year. Cancer, let's think of cancer because it's one of the biggest. There's about 1.7 million people in this country that are diagnosed with cancer in a year. But the 10-year average, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, of job losses, so job losses in this country, 10 years prior to the pandemic, so let's take the pandemic out of it, 21.7 million every year. So 21.7 million every year. And those are jobs that, yes, they come and go for a variety of reasons. One business closes, another business opens. two businesses merge, one acquires another. There's a lot of reasons for that, but think about 21.7 million. That's every man, woman, and child where you and I live in the state of Missouri, plus Illinois, plus Kansas. And that's going on every year. So the numbers are indeed staggering, but see, nobody talks about it. That's the challenge, is there's this feeling of shame and embarrassment when someone is unemployed that I don't want to talk about this. I remember when I was in high school, I got cut from the baseball team. I wasn't looking to put something out to the world and say, hey, I got cut. We keep those things to ourselves, and people do that with job loss. And unfortunately, when they do that, they limit the people that can help them because people don't know. That's one right. of the biggest struggles with it all. And then they find out later how many people that they already know that have been through job loss. So their very support system could be there to help them if they'll just let people know.
I mean, you have seen leaders for 40 years now. And one of the metaphors that you use, and let me just tell you this, and as I was reading some of this, actually, Mark, I got a little teary-eyed. I just want to tell you, I got a little teary-eyed, because you talk about the metaphor of swimming in quicksand. Can you expound on that for me? I mean, what do you mean by that? That you see a lot of leaders that get kind of in the quagmire.
Yeah. So let's go back to something we talked about before the break. When we decided that we wanted to work on leadership effectiveness, one of the avenues we pursued early on is what is impeding effectiveness? And we found busyness and distractions and complexity and meetings and emails and text messages and YouTube videos and just on and on and on. And we said, hey, that's probably it. That's the culprit. And I remember one of the very first meetings that I went to for an interview, because we interviewed lots of people for this work. And I said, hey, we think one of the challenges to effectiveness is busyness and complexity and distractions. And I remember this person being very gracious, and they listened and said, yes, 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 yes. They said, I understand all that intellectually, but those aren't my challenges. And I said, well, is there anything impeding your effectiveness? And they said, sure, it's just not your list. And I said, oh, okay, what's on your list? And they said, fear, fatigue, aimlessness. They said, and if I'm honest, I've probably got to say success, because I'm not willing to take a risk on what might be, because I'm fearful I would lose what I've already got. And so the team and I sat down and said, okay, what do we do with all this? And we said, well, it's all part of the same toxic mix. We decided to call it quicksand. And we said, the truth is that different leaders have different elements in play at any given time in their life or based on their circumstances. So then we said, okay, let's go out there and see how leaders respond to all this stuff, the quicksand. And we found three primary strategies. The first is just to swim in it, which is what you referenced. And I think this is a natural leadership response, because leaders are leaders, right? And when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and we're going to set the example, and we're going to be the role model, and we're just going to push. Well, there are a couple of fundamental problems with swimming in quicksand. One is you'll never do your best work. I've never seen anybody win a gold medal swimming in quicksand. So it's really, really hard.
Right.
Secondly, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. And I would even argue that a lot of this great resignation that we've seen over the last couple of years, I mean, there are many, many factors, and I'll acknowledge that. But I think some of the folks who were just throwing in the towel, they're exhausted because they've been swimming in quicksand, which actually leads to the second potential strategy, and that's just to quit, just to give up, just to give in. You die. Now, you might not physically die, but your hopes and dreams are extinguished in that moment when you decide to quit swimming. So swim in it, you can sink, or third, you can escape. And we found leaders who spend very little, if any, time in quicksand. So we decided that's the group we're going to study, and they're the ones that helped us identify the four choices.
We have been talking about all sorts of things, but now, you know, Joe, I'd love for you to tell our listeners about this. While you were at Hirsch and Family Entertainment, you had a very unique experience. You were tapped to be on Undercover Boss. And, you know, that particular episode, I think it was the first season, episode 7, if I recall, but 18 million viewers for that episode. It was the highest rated episode, I believe, next to one other episode, and maybe the premiere one or something. But I told you, Jenny and I watched the whole episode. My EA, Jenny Hill, and I watched the whole episode, and I cried throughout the whole. I mean, I was just a mess by the end of that episode. So we'll definitely put that in the show notes. But the one that really got me, well, two of them really got me. Richard got me. You know, and you were cleaning. Tell Richard's story real quickly, Joel.
Yeah, Richard reminded me of my father, frankly. Just very humble, soft-hearted, but really, really hardworking. And Richard, unfortunately, didn't have the proper home insurance, and he didn't have flood insurance. And the river rose up and completely flooded their home. And he was living in a pop-up tent with his four kids at the time, which I didn't realize. And you know, once I found this out, fortunately, our company had already started a foundation where our employees would give a dollar, the company would match it, the Hirschian owners would match it again. So a dollar giving became $3 in awards towards employees. And we used all that money to help employees in need. And so I applied for Richard on his behalf, and the company, the foundation, rebuilt his home and brought it up to snuff out of this foundation. And so it's very emotional in the show where, yeah, I get to know him. He finds out who I am, and we get to take care of him through this foundation. And the thing that's important, I think, well, I'll tell one other story, and then I'll draw a principle of love for all your listeners. There was another young man named Albert, and Albert wanted to be a CEO. When he found out who I was, you know, he was completely shocked. And he had been working full time, but also going to college full time and working around the clock. And because of what I saw in him, we started a foundation scholarship program. So we funded his way through college. And now Hirschian, through this foundation, they're actually, anyone who's an employee of that company, their kids can go to college for free as a benefit of the company. And it started with that one person, Albert. But I think the thing for your listeners to hear, like, everyone's not in a position to start a foundation and help all their employees. If you are, then think about doing it. But you can still choose one or two or three people that you can do things for to help them. You can't do it for everybody. Andy Stanley has a great phrase, do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. And I think that's the real important principle that I learned out of Undercover Boss is, you know, we had 12,000 employees at Hirschian. I can't help everybody, but through this foundation, we can be generous and we can help the people that apply. And then I can pick two or three people to stay with. And I stayed friends with Richard, and at least an acquaintance, and I stayed in touch with Albert. And unfortunately, Richard passed away last year of an unexpected heart attack. And I still helped his family, his wife, with some of the estate planning issues. And I still keep in touch with Albert. So the point is, do for one what you wish you could do everyone, and be generous if you can with your time or resources.
You have just done some amazing things, but here's what I really want you to do. I want to start with Facebook. And I want you to tell our listeners a story about Facebook. When you went into Sheryl Sandberg's office in 2009, she was the COO at the time. And you go in there and you're interviewing for a role on their consumer monetization team. And Sheryl said she was incredibly impressed with your product knowledge, your ability to build teams, all of this. But tell us about what happened in that interview, because it is so amazing. And there's so many lessons there in my mind.
Yeah, you know, it was 2009. And I was just, you know, I had been at eBay and PayPal for 7 years, and I loved it. And then a friend had joined Facebook, and he's like, you need to come, you need to interview for this role. And I thought, you know, why not? At the time, the company was something like 900 people. So I think it's something like 60, 70,000 today. And I met Cheryl. I mean, you know, it was not a huge company. And I pitched her, we had a great interview. And I said, by the way, Facebook should build a marketplace where people can buy and sell from each other. She kind of looked at me and she said, what? And I didn't know what she thought actually until she wrote the forward to my book, what actually her reaction was, which is she's not interviewing. She doesn't want to do the job I'm hiring her for. Should I hire her? But, you know, we ended up, I worked in consumer monetization. I love that project. I did so many cool things in the company over the years. And yet every year I pitched building Facebook Marketplace. And I thought someday I'm going to get a chance to do this if I do a really good job. So I worked on games and payments for many years. I led platform. I worked on the first direct response ad and the ad network. I helped build, you know, so many things. And then over the years, I had an opportunity to do, you know, to build teams and move around the company. And I kept every year, I would say, we should build Facebook Marketplace. And in 2015, finally, we had a chance to do it. And it was not an overnight success. It took many, many, many years to make it work. But today has over 1 billion people using it, which is so incredible. Every month, 1 billion people use this little product that, you know, I pitched. And it's been an honor of a lifetime to be a part of that because, you know, it is something which helps so many people. And the reason it was so close to my heart was that I was one of the few moms in the company as a product leader. And I was actually the only mom for many, many years. And I would buy and sell from all these people. And everybody else is like, why would you ever buy anything on Facebook? And now it's, you see all these amazing ads, you go and you can buy things. Like I sold my car on Facebook Marketplace. And so, you know, to really change your product and to build something that has such lasting impact, even to this day, even with my current job, people still say, by the way, we love Ancestry, but you built Facebook Marketplace and I just bought X, and they tell me these great stories as well. And so I do love the legacy and how it has just had such a positive impact on people's lives.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
So Zach, here's the deal. You put out so much good content, and one piece of content that I read that you put out was switching from busy to effective. And instantly my ears perked up because I just know so many busy people, and I'm, you know, sometimes I, you know, I really can fall into that trap too, but are you really being effective? And so, you know, the principles here, in my mind, apply whether it's nonprofit or for profit, really. So can you just kind of share the process that you take people through to help them move the needle from that busy to effective?
Well, I'm really honored that you would want to talk about this because I do notice that you're very busy, but highly effective people are busy. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, look for busy, get things done kind of people that you doubt would even get involved in helping you, because busy, get things done people get things done. They don't want to just, you know, goof around and not see something be fruitful and effective. So I think that anyone who's trying to be excellent and effective at what they do is going to struggle with this feeling of busyness or feeling stuck or feeling overwhelmed. I also think it's kind of like the water that we swim in right now. And so when you ask about process, I mean, the first thing I'm talking about a lot more lately is that there's a lot of things that we could share that you can do to become more effective instead of just staying stuck in this busy. But the first thing that's really hard for me to do, and maybe for you too, is we also just need to step out of the water sometimes. So instead of just flailing around in this culture that's, I'm so busy, I'm so overwhelmed, I'm so anxious, I'm so burnt out, that you can't work your way out of that. I tell people I have to work at resting. I can't just stop. That doesn't work for me. I have to work at resting. So I think that's a big part of it, is just decide to get out of the water in which we're all living in these days. But in terms of specific process, since you asked. I think that it starts with knowing what's really critically important for you as a leader that actually moves your organization forward. And so a lot of times people will tell you what their job is. They will tell you what their projects are. They'll tell you about all the things they've got going on. But if you say, what are you really, really responsible for? What are the things that ultimately someone is going to hold you accountable to as a leader, whether it's your customers or your board or your donors or your boss, if you have one, what are those things? And the reality is leaders don't typically have more than just a few, 3, 4, 5 things. And taking the time to really, really get those right. So for me, those are the vision, mission, values. You know, obviously, I'm sure that's that way for you. Financial health. I mean, if things get bad enough, I'm the one that's responsible. Shepherding people, self-leadership, thinking, planning. Those all sound easy to say, but I hate to say that it was really hard to get clear of those. So I have those written down along with just a few others, but it's usually a really short list.
Oh, Jenny, my goodness, I'm so excited about this episode. But you know, this episode really wasn't intended necessarily to be released, was it? And we just kind of, it was a crazy time in the world. What time frame was this, Jenny?
So we would have recorded this probably in May, the end of May. So like a year or 3 years ago this week.
May of
I think it was the end of May of 2020.
Yeah. And so here we had, we've been doing the podcast. We started the podcast in 2018 and we're going gangbusters and we built this. In fact, you're sitting in it today, this gorgeous podcast room that was just with all the right equipment and everything. And then all of a sudden, I think it was around May 18th or March 18th, the world shut down. And we're like, okay, well, we've got enough podcast in the hopper to make it another month. And then we're getting into it and we're going, we think it's going to be longer than a month that we're going to all be sequestered in our homes.
Right. So we all got together, the engineer and the producer and you and me, and said, what are we going to do now? So yeah, our engineer, our amazing engineer, Daniel, gave us a whole bunch of links to equipment to buy. We bought it, sent it to my house. And, so the episode that we're going to air now is that test of that equipment. That's basically what that was.
Yeah. It was our first time that we had tried doing all of this virtually. And so it was really funny because I can't remember who recently said to you and I, now, I want to hear a podcast with you and Jenny.
Zach Clark.
Was it Zach Clark?
It was Zach Clark on his episode. At the end of his episode, we were just talking and he said something about, you guys need to do an episode. It was something about, he said people who compliment each other, I think is how he got into that. And he said, you guys need to do an episode about, you know, you have your strengths and Jenny has her strengths. And I said, well, there actually is an episode.
That's right. And we should pull it out. And so that's precisely what we did. Yeah, I think really, and I loved what he said. He's just such a dear friend. And, you know, our listeners can listen to his episode when it comes out. But he had said Jenny plus Lisa equals something extra.
That's right. That's what that was. That's right.
Yeah, so I loved that. But Jenny, like in the beginning, you know, tell me what we had to do.
It was crazy in the beginning. We just didn't really know what was going on. And so we scheduled podcasts. We were able to open it up to people who didn't live in St. Louis or weren't in St. Louis, because previously we had only done in-person. Either you traveled, you know, you did it whenever you were at a conference with people who are also at the conference, or people who are in town in St. Louis or people who live in St. Louis. So those were the only ones we did. And all of a sudden it opened it up to the whole world. So our first few episodes, one of our very first virtual episodes was Albert Pujols.
Oh, you are exactly right. Because he was sitting in California and we're here. And that was amazing. Yeah. And then Todd Perry, of course, was here.
Right.
So, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that's probably one of the first virtual ones.
One of the first ones. Mm-hmm. And then we attempted, we bought three boxes of podcast equipment that we put together and with microphones and stands and headphones. And whenever we did someone in St. Louis, I would drive to their house with my mask on and leave it on their front porch and then call them from the car and sometimes sit in my car and try to connect with them to make sure that it worked.
The way, you know, me reading and the way that you described it, I mean, Lucas, very thriving, thriving community. Yeah. Thriving community. You talk about, you know, it was kind of considered the porch culture because nobody had air conditioners, right? And so people would sit out on their porch in their rocking chairs and neighbors, you know, would get to know one another. And it was just, it was a thriving community. Yeah. And now it's really described as a food and resource desert. So you decided to move your family not just to work, you know, at an arm's length, but you said, no, we're moving into the neighborhood. What were you hoping to accomplish when you did that?
I think it's really just recognizing who Jesus is, what Jesus does, and then trying to follow his lead. Like Jesus has a way of getting into all of our lives, and into the mess of our lives and really not, not being distant from us, but actually being near to us. And so if we truly want to see St. Louis changed, if we want to see North City changed, if we want to love our neighbors, love the Lou, well, then we're going to have to be there. We're going to have to, you know, incarnationally live and not just drive in as a 9-to-5. And that's easy to comprehend, and it's easy to understand that, you know, God himself stepped out of heaven and came to earth in the form of a baby. And, you know, we celebrate that with Christmas as a holiday. That's hard to do. That's a hard example to follow, but it is, I think it's the most potent example. And not that you can't do it other, you can do ministry all kinds of ways, you know, but when you get into people's lives next to them, on the off hours, that's whenever it really bears a lot of fruit.
Dana Spinola. So Dana, you opened up that first store in Atlanta, that first fabric store. You had an amazing grand opening with lots of friends, and you can talk about that. But then I want you to talk about the next morning.
You want me to talk about the part that I used to never talk about? I, you know, as a leader, or especially as, you know, the founder of your company, you think your only job is to inspire people and tell the good stuff so that everybody wants to do it. And they learn that, you know, if you work hard, then, you know, it all works out. And so I've told this story for probably 5 years and never told the second part, not because I wanted to hide it. I just didn't think it was something that people wanted to hear. And the first time I told it, I mean, I remember my mentor now says, don't ever spend time with someone who's, you know, thinking about building something or doing something that you don't tell this to. So I'll tell y'all the second part of it. But like you said, I'd opened my first store. I mean, it was a year of, I don't think I went to sleep before 2 a.m. and woke up at 5 a.m. just working on my business plan, just putting my heart and soul into this business plan. Went to 14 banks, got rejected by all 14 till the 15th, gave me a little line of credit, and I opened. And I'm from Atlanta. I went to University of Georgia, went to Roswell High School. So I'm literally calling everyone I know to show up. I just need someone to shop this store. And they did. And there was a line of hundreds of people outside, and I made every single tag myself, Lisa, every single tag. I wrote it and I wrote the price tag on it. It was not technical. Nothing was coming from a system. Every bit of heart and soul I had in here. And it started working. And we did a fashion show inside and people start buying clothing. And I just had that moment that you dream of. It really is from the movie where you're like, it's working. Look, you know, like money's coming in and this I might just pull this off, right? Yes. So I basked in that. And I think we all should, those moments of like, okay, this is what I did all the hard work for. And so, you know, ended that night out and, you know, went home, fell asleep. And that kind of sleep that you haven't had in a long time and thought I'd be sleeping in the next day to be officially open. You know, the next day was my first day really opening the store to the public. And so I get my like 40-inch heels on and, you know, jeans and skinny little jeans and top. I mean, I remember exactly what I was wearing and I pull in to my store with my huge coffee and just like, this is going to be the best day, literally to see like shimmering like glitter all down the drive. And I look to the right of the store and it's like slow motion. It really is like your brain can't really process what's happening and all the windows are busted in. And they're the shattery kind and there's like blood on them. And it's just, it's like a scene from like a movie where like this can't be. And I pull around and I walk in and it's not like a couple pieces of clothing were taken, that literally everything was gone. I mean, all the clothing was gone, but the register was gone. Every shoe out of every shoe box, the mannequins didn't have clothes on, the stereo taken. And, you know, just like a pause of, wow, you know, this really can all go in a minute. And also just the feeling of failure coming just 1,000 miles in from such a high. And I do what, you know, any business owner does. I called my dad.
I love that.
I remember being like, Dad, like, who do you call? What do you do when it all goes away? And, you know, him and I joke now, but like there was a little laugh, a little smile on the phone. He's like, welcome to your own business.
I want to talk about some of those questions, Bob. I want to talk about what it means when you're asking your colleagues and with the people in your organization the questions rather than telling them. But what do you believe are some of the attributes of a great question?
Well, Lisa, there are all sorts of questions, okay? And a lot of times we ask, and I would say it's a good question, we ask questions for our benefit. I don't know the answer, and so I say, hey, Lisa, where could I find? Or how would you do this? But I'm asking for my benefit. Now, keep in mind, nothing wrong with doing that. But mm-hmm. I kind of put that in the category of a good question. But then I have a category of better questions, and then rather than the best, I call them platinum. But let me give an example of the difference between good and better. I actually got this from a mom. A mom was telling me, she said, every day when my daughter came home from school, I'd say, honey, how was school today? And she'd say, I was lucky to get a one-word answer. Good, boring, okay, but end of conversation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she said, I was the picture of insanity. I kept using the same question every day, wondering why I wasn't getting better answers. She said, well, one day I decided, okay, I've got to change my question. So daughter comes home from school and she says, honey, tell me about your day. And she said, at first, I didn't know if she'd heard me. I didn't know if she was going to respond. There was silence for quite a while. But she said, then she began to speak. And she didn't stop for the next 5 minutes telling me about her day. And so there's an example of the difference between a good question. It's good mm-hmm. to say, honey, how was school today? You're showing interest. But the better question is, tell me about your day.
Here are some famous quotes of your dad. And then I want to get into your books and what you're doing today with Ziegler Inc. But, you know, this is one that I know our readers will recognize. If you aim at nothing, you will hit it every time.
That's one of your dads. You can have everything in life. And this is one that you kind of build your life on too. You can have everything in life you want if we will just help other people get what they want. Love that. I love this one. Cheryl Batchelder is a good friend of mine. I don't know if you know Cheryl, Tom, but Cheryl was the CEO for Popeye's Chicken. And she says this, in fact, I think I knew that this was one of her favorite quotes. I didn't know that it was your dad's, but I think I even had this inscribed for her. But attitude, not aptitude, will determine your altitude. And I think that's really awesome. There are no traffic jams on the extra mile. you know, and I could go on and on and on, but you know, for our listeners out there, look up quotes by Zig Ziglar and Tom Ziglar, because Tom's got his own quotes. But you know, you started out in the warehouse at Ziglar in 1987. I think you were stocking tapes, you know, to seminars, you know, you went from there to production to sales, and then you actually became the CEO in 1996. Was that your dad's idea to start you in the warehouse? I'm sure it was, but tell me that story.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, you know, what had happened is in college, I played college golf and I wanted to be a professional golfer. And so when I graduated from college, I needed a job that would pay for my golf habit as I was on that journey.
Yes.
And it needed to have some flexibility. So I could work early or I could work late, and, you know, shipping our orders or doing whatever they needed in the warehouse afforded that. So that's kind of how I landed in there. Plus it was a good place to start learning the business from top to bottom. But my goal was to be a professional golfer. And the better I got and the more I progressed, the more I understood how good those guys really are. So even though I got pretty good, it was nowhere near with what the guys on tour did. And I decided to move into sales, and I just fell in love with selling. That's kind of in the blood in our family. In fact, when I was born February 1st, 1965. And on February 2nd, 1965, in Columbia, South Carolina, in the newspaper, Dad put in a birth announcement. And it announced that John Thomas Ziglar, born on February 1st, 1965, as a born salesperson. So I have a newspaper clipping that I was a born salesperson.
As we wrap up, a big thank you for joining us. Our team wishes you and your loved ones a wonderful holiday season and an amazing new year ahead in 2024. Thank you for being part of our journey. Until next time, keep sharing your something extra with the world.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.